On the Mediterranean coast, an elderly professor watches history unfold through his spyglass. A fleet of decrepit ships runs aground, disgorging masses of impoverished people from the Ganges. The vessels contain countless thousands, bodies packed in layers, arms reaching skyward. As night falls, the chanting of 800,000 voices rises from the shore, while in Paris, government officials meet in crisis as Mozart plays on every radio station, Western civilization's swan song. John Respile's controversial 1973 novel presents a thought-provoking meditation on civilization's fragility. The story begins with a catalyst. At Belgium's consulate in Calcutta, a desperate mother thrusts forward her deliberately fattened child for adoption, crying, "He's not even mine now," as she points to the medal from his new family. The crowd grows daily, with presentable children displayed up front, while mothers with deformed children wait in back, their hope knowing no bounds. The myth of Western paradise spreads through famine-racked Calcutta, rivers thick with fish and fields bursting with crops. What would happen if the world's desperate masses simply decided to claim their share of Western prosperity? What moral stance could possibly justify turning them away? These questions form the novel's disturbing core, forcing us to confront uncomfortable truths about compassion, civilization, and survival. Balin, an atheist philosopher, inadvertently triggers a mass migration when his encouraging smile transforms a turd collector into a charismatic prophet. This demagogue captivates desperate masses with tales of Hindu gods inheriting the Christian god's kingdom. Along the Ganges, a crowd of 500,000 forms, entranced by this apocalyptic vision. When the prophet describes people singing on a ship approaching paradise, the crowd turns toward the actual India Star nearby. That night, Balin and fellow agitators organize supplies and a collection that even the poorest contribute to. Individuals quickly merge into a single organism with collective purpose. The turd eater boards first, holding his deformed son like a banner. Each person feels personally summoned, creating a determined rush, though many die falling between ship and pier. The exodus spreads to all Ganges ports as crowds storm 100 ships. Government authority disintegrates. One regiment even tosses their rifles into the river rather than obstruct the migration. Life aboard the refugee vessels deteriorates rapidly. These coastal trading ships become floating testaments to human perseverance. After passing Ceylon, their leader implements protocols for managing the growing number of deceased. The mortality rate remains steady throughout. Elderly passengers and children succumb first to harsh conditions and limited resources. Traditional funeral customs prove unsustainable, with initial attempts creating dense smoke across the waters. Survivors lie motionless on deck, conserving energy while dreaming of safety. Passengers endure unimaginable conditions, packed so tightly they cannot sit for weeks, surrounded by waste and death. Yet the fleet experiences unusually favorable weather, interpreted as divine providence. One vessel is lost at sea, carrying society's most marginalized. The young advisor makes the austere decision to maintain course without rescue attempts. Tragedy strikes when a Greek vessel encounters survivors. Captain Notaris makes a controversial decision resulting in significant casualties. When a crew member reveals these details to media, public opinion shifts dramatically, making opposition to the approaching fleet morally indefensible. The Western world greets news of the refugee fleet with indifference. Global crises serve merely as entertainment for bored Westerners. Momentary diversions from routine like Christmas parties that briefly animate the great thoughtless void. In the Élysée Palace, French ministers discuss the approaching fleet with detachment. Spokesman Jean Aurel delivers an impassioned speech about France's moral obligation to welcome the refugees, framing the crisis as a symbol of the rising worldwide socialist movement. This pattern persists today. Humanitarian crises unfold while we debate abstract principles without reaching solutions. At the press conference, journalist Dio orchestrates questions that spark heated debate and brands the vessel's "the last chance armada," a phrase destined to paralyze Western resistance. Australia announces it will enforce its Immigration Act without exceptions, triggering demonstrations across Western capitals. Media coverage focuses on three themes: Western paradise, the last chance armada, and Ganges culture's role in mankind's perfection. The refugee fleet unexpectedly changes course toward the Cape of Good Hope via the Mozambique Channel, a route secretly engineered by Egypt to prevent a million refugees from clogging the Suez Canal. Egypt sends its last torpedo boat to confront the armada. The admiral notices a monstrous child wearing a gold-braided cap perched on a giant's shoulders near the India Star. Through a megaphone, they warn the fleet against attempting passage through Suez, citing risks of vessel sinking. After no response and a 5-minute ultimatum, the admiral orders warning shots. The gunfire triggers an inhuman howl from the monster child, who impossibly turns his head southward despite his deformities. The entire fleet follows in a great arc. As the Ganges fleet approaches South Africa, Western papers suggest it as a logical destination. The Afrikaners respond defiantly, with their president declaring South Africa a white nation with 80% blacks and vowing that no refugee will set foot alive on South African soil. At 3 on Good Friday, the Last Chance Armada passes through Gibraltar into the Mediterranean amid celebration and prayer. Spain reacts with immediate shock. Good Friday processions become genuine religious observances, while families flee inland from coastal cities, creating opposing flows of words toward the sea and people away from it. On Easter Sunday, the president prepares his midnight address. He begins firmly, explaining that within 5 hours, a million refugees of different race, religion, and culture will land on French shores. Though most citizens find using force against the defenseless unthinkable, he initially announces the army will prevent landing by opening fire if necessary. Midway through, his voice falters. Struggling to breathe, he abandons his prepared text, asking every soldier to decide whether to accept or reject this monstrous mission. At midnight, 99 ships crash onto beaches between Nice and Saint-Tropez, with nothing moving aboard except waving arms, corpses thrown overboard, and endless chanting. A stark confrontation between compassion and self-preservation. As the last refugee reaches shore, a Mediterranean storm erupts, transforming uncertainty into action. Refugees break into buildings for shelter, with early tool finders becoming leaders. A crude hierarchy forms instantly. France has fallen, with collapse spreading globally. Corpses float past Soviet bunkers. Militants rise through New York high-rises. In London, the Non-European Commonwealth Committee demands royal intermarriage with Pakistanis. One southern village resists. Colonel Dragases and his soldiers establish a perimeter, shooting invaders and collaborators. Their stand ends when a military plane with friendly markings strafes the town hall. As attackers arrive, the defenders gather on the terrace for their final moments, choosing death by countrymen's bombs over surrender. What price must we pay for compassion? What happens when humanitarian ideals clash with cultural survival? The Camp of the Saints confronts us with uncomfortable questions about compassion's limits and civilization's fragility, questions increasingly relevant in our age of unprecedented migration.